Our first case this morning is case number 1129-28 and 1133-78, BCAP versus CAPTEC.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. I'm David Swanson. I represent the appellate, CAPTEC Franchise Trust. This, as the court is aware, is the second appeal from a declaratory judgment breach of contract case that began as a dispute over the meaning of a single sentence in a five-page promissory note and ended up as a four-year journey to answer that question after the time for answering it or exercising that provision had expired and at a point in time when no one had ever exercised the option to use the prepayment premium provision. The salient facts as it relates to the second appeal and some of the first time we were here are there 12 of these notes originated in 1999. All of the notes had a yield maintenance or prepayment premium provision for 10 years. The plaintiffs asked the trust to concur on the amount of the premium in 2007. The trust did not concur. We came here once. Then we went back for a trial that occurred. And in July 2011, almost 2 years after the prepayment premium provision had expired, the trial court determined that the trust had breached the contract by rejecting, insisting, and refusing to agree to the number in the letter sent by the borrowers or the plaintiffs. We believe the trial court erred because what happened at the trial court was a reformation of the notes, all 12 of them. Reformation was never pled. There was no mutual mistake. There was no fraud.
Well, didn't we conclude in the prior appeal that there was an ambiguity to that provision, so there would have to be some evidence on what the intent of the parties was?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We totally agree. And the court can consider extrinsic evidence, admissible extrinsic evidence, to determine the intent. What the court also determined last time was it would take sweeping changes to the language to get to the proper construction that was both then and now the basis for the trial court's decision. And what I'm suggesting and what the appellant is contending is you can't just reform a contract and then call it construing the contract, or to use where I'm from, a Texas colloquialism, you can't put a saddle on a duck and call it a horse, because the judge can write, I'm not reforming the contract, I'm construing it. But the court need look no further than its earlier opinion and the language and the decision in this case to see that is exactly what happened, as the trial judge reformed and rewrote the language. And if you want to reform a contract, that's a different standard than just construing an ambiguity.
Reformation is gap filling. What about the district court's decision in this case was in the nature of gap filling as opposed to interpretation based on the extrinsic evidence?
It was to create a gap in the sense, Your Honor, that they deleted the second part of the language that was the and the outstanding principal balance of the debt. In our reply brief at page 4, we did, and we also quoted the court's earlier opinion, to show where they added language and then deleted language. And so it created a gap by deleting language and filled in a gap by adding language, which is by definition what reformation is. And reformation is to be used in certain circumstances, but I think our briefing and our argument is reformation and construing an ambiguous term are not synonymous. They're two different things. And so in order to do that, I think it's a question of law as to whether or not what the trial court did is reformation. I don't think anyone contends that they ever pled for or asked for reformation or put on proof at the trial court level sufficient to get to reformation.
Well, by that argument, if the district court had concluded that your interpretation was correct, he would also have been reforming the contract. I mean, that runs both ways, right?
I respectfully don't think it runs both ways for the reasons I originally advanced 2 years ago, or almost 2 years ago,
yeah,
from the commercial reasonable.
So, we're not going to go back.
But the commercial reasonableness in the four corners of the document, that there have to be alternative reasonable constructions in order to, that's what an ambiguity is. And we came with two, and the court told us it was, and we understand that. But they never changed their construction to reach this result, which is exactly the one the court said was unreasonable when we were here last time.
Did you change yours? You said you couldn't reach yours either from that language.
No, sir. You know, Your Honor, we did not change ours because, one, I'm not the burden of proof. I'm not the burden of proof to to establish the breach of contract, which was therein lies part of the problem.
So what result should Judge Cosby have reached?
Well, one, I think Judge Cosby should have dismissed the declaratory judgment action as moot, because at the time it was presented to him and it was in our motion to dismiss, and he denied it. I brought it up three times. He said it was rehashing. I don't think it's out there, and I don't think it's underdeveloped. I think things are moot when, through the passage of time, nothing happened. So I think that.
Well, the passage of time was because the litigation had to occur.
All right.
You tried to prepay, you refuse it, and so they file a declaratory judgment action. Now, it doesn't get decided overnight.
Sure. So then we're left with 10 years runs, and they made a choice, and we made a choice, which also goes to my waiver argument. What the trial court should have done is dismissed that. Then the trial court should have ruled that assuming both of them are reasonably susceptible interpretations, what the trial court should have done is said there cannot be a breach, retroactive breach, of the contract when there are two disputed good faith interpretations of the contract. The court wrote that we raise good faith as an affirmative defense. That's just not the case. And one, that's not my burden of proof. It goes to whether or not there was a breach, which comes back to your question about what should the trial court have done. The trial court should have held the plaintiffs to their burden of proof of finding a breach. All the plaintiffs have ever said, they've never pointed to the language in the note. They just said, well, read Franconia. It's a great case on statute of limitations and the difference between repudiation and immediate breach. Other than that, and other than the fact that it involved a note and the judge is deciding if and when someone ever were to try to prepay, when that tolling of the limitations begin, it doesn't have anything to do with this case. So what we did in this case, and there was no ambiguity in Franconia, so what we had to do is, okay, you get sued in 2007 or you have a dispute in 2007. There's no duty in the note. Nobody's ever pointed out there's a duty in the note to say concur. Remember, that's a conditional notice, which is another legal point. Most of our points, this is a legal point. A condition precedent to satisfy a breach of contract claim was to give notice. And that notice could not be withdrawn after given. They never gave that notice. They sent a notice.
Did your client ever complain about the form of the notice, that it was conditional?
No, had no obligation to do so. No, it had nothing to perform at that point, Judge. The notice came in. We told them, they said, we would like to prepay if you concur. Okay, they don't even have to write that letter if you concur, if it's already in the documents that it's that way. So that's one way to look at it. We have no duty to say, hey, your notice is wrong. You need to fix it. You know why? It also doesn't matter because they never did. So either they can't have it both ways. Either they gave the notice and then they didn't perform, which is my prior material breach point, or they never gave the notice, which is a condition preceding to the breach. So back to what the trial court should have done. The trial court should have done, instead of being dismissive, he says, I said you can't have a breach in the past if there's a good faith dispute as to an ambiguous term. Is there a lot of law on that? Admittedly, no. We cited to Halpern. We cited to Safeco. Amgur cites Safeco, so that's really two. What we got back was, you didn't give me any cases from Pennsylvania, Indiana, or Michigan. Well, we looked everywhere for those. We could not find any. We could not find a Seventh Circuit case. That makes it a case of first impression. It doesn't make it a case that he can't answer. So the answer in the judgment was, you waived it. Well, if I raised it enough, Your Honor, that he knows that it's out there to say that I waived it, I don't believe we waived it. I believe we raised it to him, and I think that's the better reasoned decision, because the logic, as set forth in Halpern, was why should, in an ambiguous contract, why should one party bear the entire risk of loss? And as you know from our briefing, that was exactly what the conditional notice letter was trying to do, was to put us between a rock and a hard place and shift that risk of loss to us. So we believe he could have gotten rid of it, no condition preceding. He could have dismissed the declaratory judgment as moot. We think it's fully developed, and it's an advisory opinion. I think he could have done it on the condition proceeding. He could have done it on waiver. Because what they did was they paid the notice agreed. Judge Cosby, I don't know where it came from, maybe inartful drafting on my part, Judge Cosby said, well, you can't waive it by filing suit. Judge, that's not my argument. My argument is now and has always been that the waiver occurred by, one, not following the note, and two, paying the notes by the way you agreed.
You say has always been. Did you assert that waiver argument in the prior appeal?
No, sir. It was not. No, Your Honor.
Did you waive the waiver then?
No, because waiver was performance, and it had not fully occurred back in 2009, nor was it an issue relevant to calculating the yield maintenance, which was the sole issue of the first appeal. So I do not think it was waived. When we went back down, there was a genuine issue of material fact. There had been no trial, bless you. There had been no trial. So everything was, I think, before the court, subject to the fact-finding. Matter of fact, there were amendments to the pleadings after we went back down, so I don't think we waived it. Because I'm about to run into my rebuttal time, the trial court also erred and abused its discretion in a couple other ways. One was considering the inadmissible hearsay testimony. We fully briefed that. The trial court relied on three exceptions. Those exceptions were intent, which does not apply because it is offered for the truth of the matter asserted, which is exactly what the intent exception says it's not. It doesn't fit verbal acts because it's not. It's because it's offered for the truth of the matter asserted. And the third one was statements against interest. It can't be a statement against his pecuniary interest if that's what he intended all along. It doesn't hurt him, right? So we think the court erred in that regard, and I believe the court, trial court also abused its discretion in awarding, in the measure of damages it applied, the measure of damages it awarded, the interest on interest, and lastly, in denying my motion for summary judgment on the reimbursement clause. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. LaVery.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, good morning. I am Mark LaVery, and I represent the appellees in this case, and I'll refer to them as the borrowers. I was trial counsel below. 2009, this court issued an opinion at which time it was addressing a summary judgment ruling that had been rendered below, focused only on the document that contains the prepayment provision that is in dispute. It had no extrinsic evidence before it, and in that context, it was unable to reach a finding or a conclusion that corresponded to either of the positions that were advanced by the litigants then. So it said, this is ambiguous. We can't tell what it means without extrinsic evidence. Go back to trial and present that extrinsic evidence to the court so that it can interpret this ambiguous provision. That is, so that it can determine what the parties intended. It seems that the thrust of the argument that's being put forward by the appellants now is that in that 2009 opinion, when the words unreasonable were used to describe the position that was advanced by the borrowers then regarding the interpretation of the provision standing alone, somehow precludes any trial court finding in light of the extrinsic evidence that is consistent with the borrower's position. And that's just not what this court intended for us to do. We went back and had a trial. Judge Cosby considered the testimony of seven witnesses, three testified live, four by deposition. The borrowers are the only original contracting parties that presented a witness who testified about what was intended. There were 115 exhibits presented, and after post-trial briefing, a 30-page detailed opinion found, as a matter of fact, that the party's intention was just the very formula that has been advanced by the borrowers from the beginning. We think that was the right decision. It's a fact finding. The standard of review is clearly erroneous. There is ample evidence with or without the contested Bob Schrader testimony to justify that fact-finding, and it should not be disturbed. Counsel has focused this morning on suggesting to the court that the trial judge engaged in an improper or unpled reformation of the provision. That's not what happened at all. Reformation wasn't pled. I'll concede that. Reformation wasn't sought. A declaratory judgment seeking a determination about what was intended was sought, and in fact, that was the first count of the two-count complaint that was filed by the borrower some four-plus years ago now. In order to consider extrinsic evidence, Judge Cosby had to hear that which was not in the document itself and, as Judge Sykes puts it, fill in some gaps, supplement what was there to help explain or understand what the parties intended when they entered into this agreement. That's what happened at trial. If the yield maintenance argument that is being advanced by the trust now and in its brief was required as a matter of law to be the ruling in this case, we didn't need a trial. And this court would not have sent us back to Judge Cosby's courtroom for 2 days, seven witnesses, and 2 years of pretrial to find out what the parties intended. So we think the court did the right thing. I want to touch very briefly on the hearsay argument that's being made about Schrader's testimony. It sounds as if the panel is familiar. Mr. Schrader, who testified by deposition, was the point person for the lenders at the time. So he was acting on behalf of the original contracting parties at the closing that occurred in July of 1999 at his lawyer's law office in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He said, prior to the notes being executed, at Mr. First's question, this is how the provision works. He explained it. The parties were in a private conference, just four persons, two from each side. There was a break, a little bit of jotting on an envelope, perhaps some calculations, make sure it was understood. A reconvening of those four people during which confirmation of their mutual understanding was sought, and he says, that's right, you've got it. What he did then was describe what the lender's intent was with respect to the very provision that's being contested here. It's not a statement of fact. He's telling the borrower's representatives, this is what we mean. This is what we intend to happen in the event of a prepayment. So for those reasons, we think it's not hearsay. But even if you went beyond that and you wanted to consider the statement against interest exception, Mr. Schrader was, in effect, not available because closing as many loans as he did, he didn't have a specific recall or memory of this one. He testified as such in his deposition. What is recalled from that conversation when the four convened to understand what was meant by the prepayment provision and the math that it required, he looked at that provision and he had choices. Just like this court probably faced choices when it was first presented with the provision standing alone as to how it should be applied. If you interpreted that provision, or if he intended for that provision to mean what the trust has argued, that would have yielded a much higher prepayment premium. And that's why we're here, because the borrowers contended the premium should be much less than the trust said. Instead, he chose and explain the intent of the lenders to be that which yielded the lower premium. So, in effect, it was against the pecuniary interests of the entities that he represented when he made that choice and explained what was intended by the lenders with respect to the provision that is admittedly ambiguous.
And he was examined at deposition about that conversation and just couldn't remember it?
Actually, not that specifically. In his deposition, he was essentially asked very early on by the trust counsel what he could recall of the transaction, and he could recall very little. He remembered the name of the borrowers. He remembered generally there being a loan transaction that combined two big lenders, Captech Financial and an entity called CNL, they came together for this deal. But he did not remember details of the transaction. He couldn't remember the conversation itself, though I don't know that he was asked specifically about it so as to jog his memory. He just testified that he had no memory, and that's where we come to the conclusion and assert that even if you wanted to rely upon the statement against interest exception, he was effectively unavailable because he didn't have a memory. And Judge Cosby considered that in his opinion. He talked about how many hundreds of loans this guy had spearheaded in his position, and he contrasted that with the memory of the borrowers, Mr. Firth. It's a restaurant operation. It's not engaged in the business of these loan transactions all the time. So this one stood out for the borrowers. They were in financial distress. It's understandable that they would have a keen memory of this, whereas Mr. Schrader, a lawyer, who had many, many transactions going, did not. I want to turn briefly to, I guess, what I title as the arguments under this notion that having found what the parties intended, was there a breach of the contract? Because I think that was a little bit mixed up in the presentation moments ago, with all due respect. The court found two breaches occurred. One, there was the rejection of the prepayment that the borrowers wanted to make. Now, did they send a check for the whole prepayment amount? No. They didn't have to. It would have been futile to do. The record reveals that they did do just that with respect to one single restaurant entity that prior to their prepayment notice had suffered a damaging fire. Under the note provisions, prepayment was authorized. There was a dispute between the parties that foreshadowed the issues in this lawsuit about whether a premium was due or not. But in that instance, the borrowers had tendered prepayment to the servicer for the trust, and it got sent back uncashed. They knew from their communications, both orally and by email, and that testimony and those documents are in the record, that there was no way their tender of the prepayment, as they calculated it, was going to be accepted. The law doesn't require them to engage in that futile act. Their intention was clear. Their notice, which was not prescribed in any manner or form in the note, was crystal clear what they intended to do. They took the position because they knew it was going to be an issue that their calculation of the premium was correct. This notion that there's been somehow a waiver is it can't be sustained. Not only did a lawsuit get filed right after the prepayment that had been noticed up was frustrated, they had never, ever said at any point to the borrowers, your notice is defective, we don't like what it says. To the contrary, they received the notice and they said, here's our calculation for the prepayment. So they knew what was coming. They weren't the least bit puzzled or confused or uncertain about what was intended by these borrowers. There's been some suggestion that good faith ought to enter into the assessment of the conduct by the trust, you know, as if it really meant well, it can't be responsible for a breach of contract. And that's just not the law. They could be very well intentioned. They may be very good people. They stood on a position with respect to these contracts, which are promissory notes, and they were wrong. They did so at their peril. That's not a reason to excuse them from the damage assessment that was suffered by the borrowers. It's not as if we asked for or obtained punitive damages, which might require some combination of breach and tortious conduct or bad faith. That's not what happened here. I want to speak, though it's not been brought up yet, just briefly about the damage presentation, because that is challenged in the trust brief. What the borrowers had in place in order to make the prepayment that they contemplated was alternative financing through a financing agreement with the Bank of America. The interest rate was much more favorable. Interest rates had dropped, and the borrowers were in much better financial condition than they had been at the time these loans were first made in 1999. They could save a lot of money. So instead of presenting a damage claim that said, give us all of the interest that we paid you after September 1 of 2007, when we wanted to prepay but you didn't let us, what we said as the borrowers was, We want to recover that interest, but we're going to give you credit for the interest that we would have paid by borrowing from our alternative source. And it's only that differential between what we had to pay and what we would have paid had prepayment and refinancing been allowed that we sought and recovered in the $1.2 million damage award that preceded the entry of additional prejudgment interest. And on that point, we hear again the argument that, well, you've got interest on interest. You're getting a double recovery. And that's just really not true. And it's just an interpretation that sounds a little tempting at first because interest is a word that is used to describe both components of the damages that were recovered by the borrowers. Their damages in principle derive from a comparison of interest payments they made versus interest payments they would have made over the two-year period that spanned September 07 to September 09. After that's been determined, they have been, when this judgment is rendered in 2011, they have been without those funds for a period of time, and they're entitled to be compensated with prejudgment interest for the time value of those funds that was lost, that they were without. And that's why on the post-trial motion to amend, Judge Cosby saw fit to award prejudgment interest on the damage amount that had previously been awarded to us in the main judgment. Those are the comments that I wanted to make. If there are no questions, I'll be seated. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Swanson, how much time? Got plenty of time.
Thank you. The question asked earlier, Mr. Bilveri, I had mulled over before I got here for some time, and I framed it a little bit differently, which would be if I'm contending that the trial court erred and that's an unreasonable construction, is it possible for parties to agree to an unreasonable contract construction? And I thought, perhaps I might get asked that question, but I thought I at least ought to consider that as a possibility. I think the short answer to that is I think parties can't agree to unreasonable contract provisions that make no economic sense. But then you have to ask the follow-on question is, to what end? Where does that lead? Because it's not in a vacuum. It's only part of the agreement between the parties. So you need to look at what that is. And in their brief and in just now, Mr. Bilveri says, well, I keep attacking the weight and the credibility of the evidence. I'm talking about conclusions of law and legal decisions that I believe this court can review de novo and make its own independent determination on things such as the condition, whether or not it's a breach. Mr. Bilveri said passionately that good faith, he goes, that's just not the law. He's got no case that says it's not the law. I've got only got two cases that suggest it is the law. It's not. He cites three cases in his brief on good faith that deal with whether it's a defense for an insurer in a declaratory, I exercise good faith in not paying a claim. That has nothing to do with it. What we're saying is you have two sophisticated parties who are in a dispute over an ambiguous contract provision. Can that be a breach? Because if you follow on to his next point, and I'm doing it in reverse order, I apologize. He said I didn't address the breach correctly. Judge Cosby found two breaches. I think I did. He said we rejected their number and we insisted on a different number. Well, when did we do those things? We did those things in 2007. But when did it become a breach to reject and insist? It only became a breach when years later Judge Cosby said, oh, no, this is what the original parties intended. It's not in the document. It has to be subject to extrinsic evidence. What was the holder of commercial paper, my client?
Mr. Swanson, with respect, that argument makes no sense whatsoever. You can't possibly be taking the position that there was no repudiation of the attempt to prepay.
There was a disagreement.
There was a disagreement about what the prepayment clause required them to pay.
Absolutely.
So you didn't allow them to pay, and that is a breach. It, and they filed suit over that breach during the 10-year period. And so your mootness argument, your argument that there was no breach,
there has to be a duty to perform, Your Honor. And I'm trying to answer.
They had a right to prepay under the contract, and
once they knew what the number was.
Right, but that is not contingent upon a court telling you which side's interpretation is correct.
How else would
to take the position that repudiation of the prepayment right doesn't become a breach until a court chooses between the two sides' competing interpretations, just shuts down all contract law.
No, let me try without – I heard that it made no sense. It makes perfect sense if it's an executory contract that's continuing. We were here before, and I'd never made that argument in 2009 or prior to that, because there was still a window and a possibility in time that those could happen.
Right, and that permits you, the breaching party, to run out the clock. It makes no sense at all as a matter of contract law.
But so if that's true, then the trust sold – remedy or the sole conduct that it could have done to avoid being here today would be to acquiesce in what was asked of it, please concur, even though it was reasonable in this point.
You take your chances. You assert your interpretation of the contract and you take your chances in court.
But it's not my burden.
And you don't litigate whether there's been a breach or not. You litigate the interpretation of the contract, which is what you've done, and you've lost.
Yes, Your Honor. And all I'm saying is I think the burden of proof is on them to show that, and I don't think they've met that burden of proof for the reasons we've stated, and especially if you consider the inadmissible hearsay that we asked to be excluded. And without it, there is no evidence of the other party's intent, so you cannot get to the legal conclusion, which is a de novo review. I'm about out of time. If the Court has any other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. And our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.